right now you're feeling a bit like Alice, tumbling down the rabbit hole? This is your last chance. After this, there is no turning back. You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
Deeper Down the Rabbit Hole. Now live, Tuesdays, 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Para-X Radio Network.
Welcome to this week's episode of Deeper Down the Rabbit Hole. This is Jason M. Caldwell, who is sick and tired of putting up with the BS. Along with my co-host, Zachary Louie. Zach, how are you doing?
Hey, okay. Though I'm on the same page as you on that, so.
So, brother, first off, I want to thank you for going the extra mile, because you took up the mantle doing a little bit of extra scheduling for the show. And you went and found us somebody, and you love to get the Asian Eastern philosophy people in general.
Oh, yeah. In general.
Well, for some reason, we thought we had a cool guest for you guys tonight. We thought we did, but the guys seemed to think that Arizona was 3 hours ahead of Eastern Standard Time, so we opted to do a pre-record for him. So that's 5 p.m. is too late for you. Okay. Well, then it turned into we are now pre-recording on Sunday, and we blocked this out of our schedules during our days off from work, and we can't get a hold of the guy. He'll probably contact us 3 hours from now.
Who knows, right? So, he may pop on a show, he may not, we don't know, but...
I'm not going to embarrass him, I'm not going to name his name, it's just... This isn't the first time we've had to deal with things like this, so...
No, it's not, but we just roll with punches, and here's your show, everyone.
But here's the thing, okay, Zach? Do not let me slaughter any of this info, so... You got involved at a young age doing the kung fu with it was Buddhist monks.
Yep, I had a Shaolin monk teacher, and it was pretty much like the thing of the movies. We said no names to each other. We had nicknames.
Nice. What was your nickname?
Boy.
Literally, boy.
That's all he called me. It was like, boy. I was like, okay.
Did he call everyone boy, or was it just you?
No, it was just me.
Damn, were you the youngest one in the class?
Yes.
Okay.
Mind you, okay, he kept calling me that even though I was like 17, and I was still older than other people at the time.
Oh, you were 17. Oh, man, I thought you were doing this like in
your... Oh, no, I was doing it when I was years. A kid. I was doing it when I was a kid, but that term just stayed with me when I went to revisit him in my teens. Like, 17. There was a kid that was about, I'll say probably like 13 years old, and he didn't call him boy, but he kept calling me boy, though I was older than him, so...
Why does everybody else get the cool names? Everybody else gets grasshopper or whatever. I get boy.
I just get boy.
No, honestly, it probably means the guy liked you.
Yeah, he was a great teacher. I mean, he moved out somewhere in the backwoods somewhere. and disappeared, but he was great for when I was learning from him and set a very high standard.
Disappeared in the backwoods, really?
Yeah, he just disappeared, kind of like backwoods where, like, I only know sort of what area he's in, but there's no specifics.
That's your next Kung Fu challenge, Zach. You have to travel on foot and find the new temple. That's your next test. Yeah, apparently.
It was actually, back in the day, it used to be in a church that it was, like, renoed. So it wasn't a working church, but he did it in a church, which was hilarious to me.
Yeah, that kind of makes sense. I mean, well, look what churches have done over the centuries, man. Go find somebody else's holy ground and knock it down and go, this must be holy space. We'll build a church here. Oh, man. Yeah, I did a self-defense course in a church for people many years ago.
Oh, yeah? How was that?
Yeah, probably a little bit too hardcore. If you want to know my style of how I teach people to fight, go watch Cobra Kai.
Yeah. I mean, after that Botswana class at Convocation we did a few years back.
But, yeah, I think when it got to the point that I was teaching the girls how to break people's arms, they were kind of like, maybe we don't want you to come back. But that's they didn't say that right directly, there. But they just didn't reschedule, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. But the way I see it, if somebody's going to attack you, literally, they deserve no mercy.
Well, that's kind of the take. I mean, the old adage where, like, Kung Fu looks fancy, it's like, nope, you basically just go for whatever you can, that's an opening, and then you get the hell out. It's pretty much like Marines.
Yeah, except when you're working out and trying to look pretty, it's really just about getting in there and getting the job done.
Yeah, I mean, usually prettiness and aesthetics ain't the first thing you're thinking about from a practical Kung Fu standard, but that's a little bit different these days.
But, you know, the reason I kind of brought that up is because I know that you've gotten that early background in Buddhism, you've had some background in Taoism yourself, and it's always interesting, man, because Eastern philosophy is so much about thinking outside of the box, especially, I mean, okay, you're an American, you were born here, but you spent most of your life in Canada, but, you know, you're pretty westernized, but you've had the exposure of having a Western upbringing, but at the same time being taught the Eastern philosophies.
Well, right. I mean, it's very much on the point of, you know, live in Canada all my life type of thing, but even the exposure there, it's a melding of worlds. I kind of get the best of both worlds. It's like, yeah, I'm very Western in many ways, but there's a lot of Eastern stuff that I don't take at face value. Like, I actually do question it, and I do see value in it, so I keep it in my life. But it's one of those things where, this is going maybe get into some dicey territory, but it's like, you know, you get brought up in predominant culture, and there's assimilation points and preferences, but there's a point where you need to question things because you could just be running old habits. At that point, that is more of a prison mentality.
So, you've done some ceremonial type work, summoning of spirits with me and Andrea. Mm-hmm. And have you had the opportunity to do some of the Taoist spiritual work? And if you have, I'm very curious how that differs.
Well, yeah, I have. Not to the extent I would like, because, you know, one step at a time. I mean, most of my personal practices, you know, I vary as a chaos magician on things. I like to do more work in the Taoist frame, but in terms of the work, all of it generally goes from a premise of, well, there's different paradigms, we'll say, but, you know, it's primarily working with the energy paradigm first. And it's a very left-hand path way of looking at things, actually, if I have to put a Western context tag on it. Even though they would say it's like, oh, it's right-hand path by Chinese standards, it's still a very left-hand path way, because it's very much of, how do you become one with your environment? Well, you do that by actually building enough energy in yourself to make yourself worthy of working with spirits. saying you are one of them.
Ah, so it begins with the principles of personal power.
Right, because as much as this Chinese or Eastern notion of go with the flow and all these things happens, it's very much of how do you actually develop power within yourself, because it gets into all sorts of stupid hardcore stuff where it's like you start making your body into a talisman. You start putting spirits in your organs because you need a portable altar. All this type of stuff. And it gets to insane levels where I've actually researched this with Andrea on a few points. And I'm just like, yeah, this is kind of a necessary stupid, but that's, if you're going that route, it's all about personal power first. And then the environment will shift around you. Unless you're in nature. That's a different thing, but at that point you're being one with nature.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, though, it's not so cut and dry, though, man, because it's... Okay, there are really, really hardcore left-hand paths where it's like, I've had people discuss the left-hand path with me and go, either one extreme of, no, I don't believe in external spirits. If they exist, they're part of us anyway, so I'm just going to work on myself. But I've also had people go, no, I know there's external spirits. I've had experiences with them, but screw them. I don't want their help.
Yes. And literally, that's when I'd say it becomes a gray line, at least in Taoism, because you have, I would say, the magician priest, or you have someone that is a layman, and that's not really to insult what layman is, but there's this devotional community side, and everyone has a different preference on where their leanings are toward. When you start seeing those leanings on the devotional point, that's kind of like... you know, going to your southern church congregations. Like, you know shit's rolling, but you may not know the mechanics behind it. And then if you want to step up as a priest or start doing that type of magic work, then you gotta figure out the technicals.
I just think it's interesting to go, okay, I need to earn my way to showing the spirits I am one of them, but at the same time I'm going to incorporate them into myself internally on purpose to, what would be the right wording, Zach, when you put them, when you start talismizing spirits, are you alchemizing them into you, or are you putting, like, making that organ a talisman to contact that particular...
You're making that organ a talisman because you're supposed to actually... This gets into more advanced Nei Gong, Qi Gong stuff. But at the highest levels, it's kind of like you're supposed to actually have the spirits in your organs. That means you need to have a pretty good relationship with those spirits in the first place.
Right.
Because it's physically in your organs, but then they can benefit your health.
So
this is our longevity practice now.
Right, so the whole idea of I might dedicate a talisman to a particular angel or demon and work with that angel or demon repetitiously, but then have that charged talisman on my altar, you're doing similar but putting it in you so it's always with you.
Right, that would be a variation of Taoist work there, where you're literally using your organs as talismans to hold a charge, and you would keep feeding it through various ways. You could do it through the rituals, you could do this through Qigong, you could do it through a lot of different ways. Because at least when you were a Taoist historically in China, you didn't really have a place to stay to make a nice altar. That was more of a Confucian thing, and possibly a Buddhist thing, but not a Taoist thing, because the Taoists were the closest thing to this civilized shaman you can get, as I would joke around. Because shamans are on the outskirts. Taoists were kind of like, they were closer to society on that level, but not much.
Well, there's quite a few, I mean, there's Taoist stuff that talks about nature spirits in a way akin to fairies, wouldn't you say?
Oh yeah, I mean, even the Chinese translation on Qian could be fairies or immortals.
I find it very interesting. I have a book floating around somewhere that I've wanted to actually do some of the... Well, it's not really a traditional magic book, but it says enough about the system to be able to replicate some of what they're doing.
Uh-huh.
Actually going out and putting talismans in trees in a woods that you believe has spiritual activity.
Right. because I know, like, when you start looking at Taoist talisman work with the paper and stuff like that, like, they would have charms on, like, how do you get away from a tiger or a wolf and shapeshifting and all these types of things that you would say, like, okay, that's either shapeshifting or more fey work.
No. Here's the thing, man. I know that I've seen some strange news articles as of late. Like, there was some... I can't remember if it was India or where. But basically, a village was being messed with by a tiger.
Uh-huh.
And the villagers became obsessed with the idea that the tiger was a shapeshifter, and they went after the tiger, and the tiger killed at least one of them.
Right.
Well, the news comes back, the media comes back with poo-poo on them. How naive could they be to believe that this tiger was a shapeshifter? They ended up killing the tiger, I think, and the tiger was just, quote-unquote, as the news put it, a tiger.
Right.
But, you know, and, you know, somebody's going to flame me for this, but the thought actually crossed my mind, not to be conspiratorial, not to be a fruitcake, but I'm looking at it like both could be true.
Theoretically. Both could be true if you actually understand what shapeshifting is. Like, this gets into a point of so many different variants of magic now. Like, is it a literal shapeshift? Is it a mental possession of an animal, which is an actual technique? When you start getting to the higher levels of Taoist work, where you actually start controlling animals with your mind. Mind you, you gotta practice a hell of a lot, and that could be viewed as a siddhi from a Hindu Vedic standard. But, like, there are actual rituals you can do and actual techniques around that that build specifically around that specific skill set.
Oh, I know a guy I used to work with that has a very strong astral eagle that he flies around as, and now that's a spiritual form, that's not a physical form, but he comes back with all sorts of information about people he shouldn't know. I've got, like, a little astral, what do you call them, auto turret set up around here just in case he comes around. Boom, 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 boom. I don't like people looking at me when they're not supposed to be looking at me. You know what I'm saying?
Well, yeah, we all like our privacy on that. But this gets into, this opens into a lot of different conversations. And, I mean, Andrea covers it extensively in his shapeshifting course. So if all y'all be interested in that, I'd say definitely sign up for it, because, you know, as a co-moderator on that and having, like, helped him in working with that particular course he created, there's a lot of techniques there around the stuff, which I would say from a Taoist perspective, he's right on the money.
Oh, yeah, here's the thing, man. People don't get upset with me about cultural appropriation or whatever, because I'm just exploring the possibilities as an investigator, looking at it as an outsider, and the stories that I've read that have come from what seems to be legitimate sources. But, you know, you have these beliefs in places like India, you have these beliefs in places like China, the Native Americans have similar beliefs. The idea that one's mind can possess an animal, or that physically some people can transmute themselves from one physical form to another. Jury's out for me if the physical transmutation is the stuff of legend to explain what's going on spiritually. That's more what I lean toward, if that makes any sense.
Uh-huh.
I think the possession of another creature is a lot more likely. And I know people are going, oh, he's jumped the shark now, but...
This gets into a lot of things, like...
You don't, but think about the audience. But go on, make your point.
The point I was going to make, it's kind of like, this starts going to more conspiratorial things, but it's like the men that stare at goats. I mean, that movie, it's actually based on stuff like this.
Yeah, and then I also believe that, like, okay, the government's official What the government seems to say officially about projects like that is they were rendering results, but it was so much work per actual usable information. Basically, mm-hmm. they found it to be a bit too strenuous for the amount of vague information they were getting back, even though the information tended to be accurate.
Right.
Truth be told, unless you are a monk of some kind of spiritual person that can hang out somewhere and your full-time job is spiritual work, I kind of get that. I do get that, because I'm a firm believer in things like astral projection, which is a step behind. Okay, if my physical, not physical, but if my mental consciousness, I won't even go as far as saying soul, I'm just going to say my mental consciousness can move away from my body and observe things at a distance, which is incredibly strenuous, hard work. This is not something you walk up to me and go, hey, Jason, I want you... No. You got to give me a month of meditation time and all kinds of crazy prep work. It's hard. But I've done it. But it's hard. The thing is, if I can go that far, why couldn't I take that same traveling consciousness that's viewing things at a distance and viewing them accurately and superimpose that over another physical form? I guess you get into some ethical questions there, but you could potentially even do that to other people.
Right, that gets into more psi stuff. And I mean, isn't it, I'm just trying to think of the one book. I think there's an exercise in high magic that does that too.
The exercise in high magic, if I remember correctly, is actually
like, you're supposed to focus on a dot on somebody, and you're supposed to make them turn around.
Yes, and that's more of a tele... Oh, I'm going to say this one. That's almost more of a... what's the old psi word for being able to talk back and forth with your minds?
Oh, I know what you're talking of. I forget the term. Because yeah. I haven't looked at that stuff in a long time.
Well, I think people get it. Being able to speak to each other with your mind, which is actually a strange experience. Telepathy.
That's it.
And here's the funny thing. I've heard more than one story. I'm not a huge user of hallucinogenics, let's just say that there was a time that I will admit to that Sabi Divinorum was legal where I live, and I did try it, and I had some very interesting experiences with that. But yeah, I'm not the kind of person to go drop acid or something like that. And one, it's illegal. Two, because even if it weren't illegal, this kind of stuff you're getting off the streets right now isn't pure. It could be dangerous for your body, and I don't like taking risks like that. I was slipped some hallucinogenic once unknowingly and had a very frightening experience. But that being said, I've had more than one story of people coming to me where they were doing hallucinogenics with other people, and a couple of these sessions were tape recorded, and after the fact, they commented back and forth to each other about conversations they had during that experience, and were able to both recall and go back and make commentary, but then they found out upon viewing the audio tape, they never actually had those conversations. These were times of quietness. These were times when, yes, they were having a shared astral experience, perhaps, or a shared telepathic experience, but not a physical experience. I find that very interesting.
Well, I mean, this is where I like having categorizations. I know they're limiting, but this is where, at least in the Chinese sphere, I mean, every culture has its different ones, but the Chinese one would say you got your jing, which is your physical, your qi, which is just the energy, and then you got your shen, or consciousness. At that point that you're discussing, that's pretty much on the shen level of work.
So shen, you would call like the movement of consciousness rather than the movement of, say, your essence.
Right, because jing is actually your essence or the material. Chi is more on the energy level where it could go back and forth, but it's more like a super glue that kind of pulls everything together. Shen, your consciousness, this is very much that mental aspect or that spirit aspect within yourself that could do multiple things at once you train it. So then even in the Neigong or Taoist, and I could argue Buddhist stuff, they would say, you know, ultimately we start you at the Jing level because we need you to get material results. But as we keep working up and refining that essence, you'll start getting much more spiritual type of work or results. And it should be able to go back and forth on that.
Hmm. Very interesting. So, what's your opinion, Zach? Do you think that there's some people that might actually be able to take it as far as the full physical shapeshift, where their physical body is transmuted into something that's not necessarily human?
I don't know. I mean, would I say the likelihood of that is very high? No. But I would say, you know, can there be physical shapeshifts partially? Well, we know that's happened even from a possession standard.
Yes, definitely.
And I would not put that outside the framework, because what is that when you're actually doing a shapeshift? Aside from your own aspecting of oneself, that is a possession on that point.
Well, you know what's funny? Okay, for one, when Andrea talks about eye color changes during ritual, he's not BSing. I've seen it.
Oh, yeah.
But the thing is, I could always kind of poo-poo that a little logically and say, okay, we were all in a trance state. Maybe that was a psychic phenomena. Maybe our minds were melded in a way that we all just observed it like that. But then we did some work where Andrea led some work at Convocation a few years back, where I watched a girl with a crippled hand go through some of those shapeshifting techniques, and she was able to actually get full mobility of her hand for a limited period of time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I saw that girl's hand before she did it, and I saw that girl's hand afterwards. That was a lot more than mind over... That wasn't just mind... I mean, it was mind over matter, but it certainly was not just a psychic phenomena, not just a mental phenomena. That was a physical phenomena.
Well, right. And, I mean, even from my experience around those types of things, it's... Yeah, there's a physical component to it that can last. Now, how well your neurology will actually kick back, that's a different question, because remember, you've just opened a new neural pathway to resolve that point issue, meaning you still have at least the old pathways there until you change it.
Mm-hmm.
So if you've trained it consistently, yeah, you could probably switch that out. I know, even if we just talk on a mundane medical level, there's acupuncturists that are able to do certain techniques that can get a person walking after a stroke in 3 days. Like, legitimately walking after a stroke in 3 days.
Oh, wow.
And that's, you know, that's an acute one, but they've also done it for chronic ones, too, where the person didn't know about said acupuncturist for about, you know, we'll say like a year, and they're still walking. It takes a little bit longer, but they're walking in a good chunk of time fairly fast. So I think we can't discount that point on mind over matter, because in this particular technique of acupuncture, which isn't a very well-known, talked-about school, it's you're actually utilizing Qigong techniques with acupuncture to reprogram your neurology to say, no, we don't want this programming. So in some ways, we could view shape-shifting in a similar context.
You know, this is going to seem extremely bad of me, but I think people working on techniques like that are a needed thing, and I think that they should have clinics for people that want to get better on certain points where they can be isolated for a while, away from everyone else.
Now, yeah,
do you have any idea
kinda...
why I would say that?
Well, so they can refine the techniques more.
No, beyond that. Well, yes, so that they can have focused training, but at the same time, okay. Imagine, if you will, the fact that we were able to get enough people in a room in a like mindset and non-judgmental mindset that Andrea was able to lead a technique where someone with a crippled hand was able to loosen up and get normal usage of that hand on a temporary basis. Now, if she wanted that progress to continue and she went home and practiced similar techniques, think of the resistance she's going to get from people around her that are going to be like, yeah, you're full of it. Something like that could never work.
Right, and at that point you want to put them in an isolation tank to more or less push that through. Because now we're talking about community dynamics. Remember, when you're doing this stuff in China, which this is primarily where it's at, it's still much more community-based healing in many ways. They may be going to the hospital every day, or they may see that acupuncturist every day, but they're still getting access to a community that would support them. Because I've watched those videos and I've done my research, and they're like always saying, the person's like, no, I can't do this. This is impossible. And one of the key points to the system is you would always say, no, it's not impossible. Move your arm a little bit more, even if you have to raise it physically yourself. Because that's still you moving it more. So there's a lot of encouragement in that. You try and do that here, you may not get that in the West.
Well, and the problem is, too, man, in the West, we've had some hardcore bad examples, like the faith healers. You know, preachers that took a lot of people's money and set up and staged encounters with people who weren't really sick and weren't really crippled to make it look like they were healing the crippled and the sick, right? Funny thing is, even a church that I used to be involved with believed in the power of belief in a negative aspect. Like, they were talking about missionaries talking about a woman in a village who had to be restrained at night, literally tied to her bed. And the missionaries were really concerned about this. Why are you tying down the old woman? Because if we don't tie down the old woman, she turns into an animal and she goes and she kills our livestock at night. As an example.
Well, right.
Or there was demonic possession cases I'm talking about, like, missionaries that saw manifestations like extreme physical strength from little children. One claims to have viewed, I've never physically seen a levitation myself, but I've spoken to a missionary, claims he did see someone physically levitate once while under possession.
Right.
Things like that. And I, you know, back then I wasn't an occultist. I was still like a paranormal investigator, but I asked questions like, hey, why were you seeing things like that in foreign countries, but we haven't necessarily seen that here? And I was told, well, over there, they don't believe it's not possible. They believe it is possible, and because they believe it's possible, the quote-unquote demons can accomplish more.
Well, right, and but this gets into belief structures and what's culturally accepted and what's not. I mean,
right.
I'm going to be running a workshop on energy work June 2nd, and we're talking about this geocultural influences on the energy system, because it does make a huge difference. If you're doing like Vedic or Hindu work, there's certain buy-ins you have to accept right off of the bat if you're doing that compared to Qigong. That has a different set of buy-ins. Mind you, as much as they're both excellent systems, they both have their pros and cons. And you're not going to take a hammer to a screw. It's just not effective. So you work with the best tool for the best situation.
It is true.
And I mean, when we start looking at those things that are accepted, it's like, yeah, there are certain cultural things that may be accepted more in Hindu stuff that you would not find in Chinese stuff, nor, say, Judeo-Christian Kabbalistic work. Because, right, you're buying into a cultural paradigm right off the bat. I mean, you get all those associations with it.
You know, it's interesting, Zach, because, well, first off, Did you say June 2nd you're going to be doing that?
Yeah, June 2nd I'll be doing a cross-panel RG work workshop.
How do people get involved in that, man?
They would just send me email at admin@wujishuan.org, and they just put in their seating. We got limited seating because Clay can only hold so many people. But they would just shoot me an email on that, and then they get entry.
You should make up a little blurb about that along with that email address, because, sorry, dude, I wouldn't be able to type out that address right now. But you send me that info. Okay.
I'll send you the info.
You send me the info, I'll put it up on this week's show page. That way when people hear the show, they'll be able to reference your email and the information about the clinic.
Yep.
But, well, dude, I mean, that's really, it's, okay, I have a really hard time sometimes when people go, well, what exactly is chaos magic? Well, the essence of it is the fact that a bunch of people got together with different beliefs and realized that they had common threads and technique and started to come together and realize developing the philosophy of chaos magic under the techniques seem to be what makes the magic work, not necessarily the dogma.
Exactly.
But there's also a point to chaos magic when you work with a system that's foreign to what you've normally worked with. You try to buy into the beliefs of that system. Buy in so that you try as hard. This is way easier said than done, folks.
Uh-huh.
The whole idea of you have to unlearn what you've learned. You have to try to throw out the biases you already have in your head that are going to work against that technique being able to be effective in the first place.
Well, right. I mean, even if we were to take an example with you, I mean, you're fairly based in ceremonial magic, I would say. But when we start rolling the Hindu stuff, I mean, you buy right into the system and you try and educate yourself as much as you can, as if you were a native.
Because it scared the crap out of me, man.
Well, still, that's you educating yourself.
Well, first off, I did the... And I'll tell you why it scared the crap out of me. In a good way. I mean, the first experiences, thank God, were very positive and not very scary, but they were still overwhelming in a sense. The thing was, okay, I had to ask, like, okay, so we're gonna take these mala beads, we're gonna do so many repetitions of a particular mantra, and we're gonna visualize a certain deity. The first time it was Ganesh. And while going through this technique of a ceremony, I'd say the first time I didn't hallucinate, but I went very, very deep into trance. So I knew that I was using an effective technique based on the amount of trance that I was going into. Mm-hmm. And I felt that the point of the ritual did get results. So deep trance and results equals there's something going on here. I'd say the second time I actually did have a hallucinatory experience with the deity involved, being Ganesh. So that was interesting. This led to later on down the road having a very strong experience where Shiva showed up when I was doing a Ganesh working. When Andrea was leading a Ganesh working that I was involved in. And he showed up and in this hallucination/vision hands me a demon dagger and said, there's someone interfering with the ritual, go take care of this. And then I snapped out of it. When I snapped out of it and opened my eyes, Andrea has a blessed demon dagger that he tends to keep near his altar when he's doing Hindu work. That demon dagger had rolled off the altar and was laying right in front of me. A little scary, huh?
Yeah. But it goes into, you're treating that as a very different paradigm, and you're getting different results compared to your ceremonial magic. If we're doing angelic work, that's a whole different mindset you have to take.
Yeah, but at the same time, I'd say a common thread, two very different techniques of getting there, but the point of both types of ceremony is to drive yourself deeper and deeper into trance So, the best way I can describe it is when I do very intense ceremonial work, I'm having both a physical and an astral experience simultaneously. Mm-hmm. Because when I'm hitting the switches right, when I'm really driving myself where I need to go, you have to understand, like, a Lesser Banishing Ritual of the Pentagram, nice cliche way of opening up a ritual, I'm very focused on every individual step of that. And every individual step is driving me more into a trance-like state as I'm going through them. I'm not just going through the motions. One could go through them. I've read this for years. People go, oh, those Golden Dawn rituals work because they've developed an egregore, and the egregore of the ritual is enough to get you where you need to be. Well, you know what? Maybe they're not completely full of it. Maybe there's a little bit of added help in the ritual because of how many times they've been repeated throughout the years. I'll give them that. But sure. But you have to do your work too, and if you're not, you could very easily go through the steps of those rituals.
And, well, right, and not get the same results that other people would be. I mean, what you're really describing is, well, progressive steps to get you deeper into trance. So it's like step one, step two, step three, but you keep hitting a different layer every single time.
You didn't try to send me a private message, did you? Because I got a ding on my end of the computer, and I can't figure out where it came from.
I had a ding, too, about maybe a minute or two ago. So, okay.
Well, we'll call it a strange anomaly. I don't see anyone sending a message, so we both heard it, though, so it's weird. Okay.
Yeah, I thought something on my computer screwed up on that, but apparently it is simultaneous, so there you go.
Who knows? Maybe you and the audience heard the ding, too. Hey, you know what? It's Sunday evening here, and at least the 4th Street drag strip's been quiet today, huh?
Yes, it has. But yeah, so, I mean, summarizing the conversation piece, I mean, we're going back and forth so much, but we've flipped through a lot of different topics.
We have, but I think, I always, whenever we have to shoot off the hip like this because something went not as planned, I think I'm just going to title this Jason and Zach East Meets West or something. I don't know.
We'll see. all of y'all listen to us, you'll see the title on Tuesday. So, yeah. I mean, I think the cultural paradigm is a major thing when we start talking about energy systems, particularly because, again, major influences. But, yeah, we're going back to chaos magic steps in many ways. How do you get to that trance state? What is the common technique, and here's your flavor? Indian flavor is different than Chinese flavor. Never mind Japanese flavor, etc.
Here's the thing. I've heard about some of the ghost encounters friends of mine have had over in places like Japan, China. Mm-hmm. Eastern places. You could tell me if this is a Taoist or Buddhist. I think it's a Taoist thing, but you could tell me if there's other cultures that do this kind of thing. I know what they tend to do in some of these places is people will experience a spirit, a haunt of some kind, and they'll end up putting up a little altar out in the street, and people leave offerings like, hey, leave me alone. Hey, leave me alone. And what kind of culture is that?
I just generally say that's generally Eastern culture, because it goes with the idea. I mean, I could argue the same thing in the Southern states and conjure in many ways, and maybe even Eastern parts of Europe, like I and Africa. I think it's a fairly common thing, but you definitely see this in the Eastern culture where they're like, oh, well, you know, things at the door, things bugging you, bribe it.
Right, but they'll publicly bribe some things, and passersby will go ahead and, you know, pay their respect so that they can cross through that little patch of woods that everyone else says is haunted, right? And they'll pay their respect, and they'll leave an offering, light the incense or what have you, and then walk on through and be left alone. Well, then what happens is somebody else comes along and goes, oh, look at this silly nonsense, and walks on through without paying their respect, and they have a scary encounter.
Well, right. I mean, it's like, you know, in Japan in particular, you have the spirit houses. You don't see this so much in China, but definitely in Japan, you have these little spirit houses that you would just say, here's an offering to the spirit, because it takes a very totemistic, atavistic polytheistic type of attitude where it's like everything's a spirit. So if it's like, you know, spirit of the door, spirit of this. So if you want to work with a particular spirit, you give it an altar and you say, hey, do your job better. Right? And then you would feed it and all these things. So in some ways it could be a servitor when you start thinking about it. Could be a separate spirit. Could be so many different things that you're working with on that point.
Yeah, you're right. It could be various things, but I think the common theme I see, the reason people will have particular experiences in certain locations of, say, Japan, is because there is a social consciousness working toward empowering whatever is there that we do not have here.
I would definitely agree. I mean, it's very common. I joke around with people when they come see me, but, and I even mentioned this on a few other radio shows, I think, that I was on, but it's like feng shui. It's a very common thing to have chimes and, you know, put this item out for good luck, like lucky cats. It's a typical Chinese, Japanese thing. Buy a lucky cat, mm-hmm. Your place is going to be more lucky. There's a social consciousness there. It doesn't matter if you've empowered the thing or not. There's a belief system around that. Never mind if you actually put some extra juju in that. But this type of conversation is a very common one. Like, most Chinese people, I could say Chinese, but I could say other Eastern cultures too, or at least Far Eastern, but it's very much on the point of, it's so common that people would be like, shouldn't you like be, like, if I were playing this in a Western context, they'd be like, oh no, you put that down though, and you don't talk about it. In the Eastern stuff, we let the freak flag fly on that and say, like, okay, yeah, that's normal. It's normal to have a lucky cat that brings you money. It's normal to have feng shui things to change the energy of the environment and have statues and stuff to bring you good luck of that spirit if we want that trait in our life.
So lucky cat's a little ceramic thing that I've seen at some businesses, right?
Yeah.
So, or, what's the belief, like, educate me in the audience, what's the belief behind that thing? Like, is there some kind of deeper story to it that one should know before having one, or is it just a thing where it's considered not cultural appropriation to have one?
I would say it's not cultural appropriation to have one. It's such a wide thing. Has it gone to the commercial spectrum? Yes. But the origin of the story, I'll take the Japanese one because I am forgetting the Chinese one. But the Japanese one is, there was a poor man and he literally was broke. He was starving, but he had a pet cat. And we're getting back into animal possessions here, or shape-shifting. But the cat, you know, he's taking care of it, and he gave it his, like, he would feed it every day even though he had not much. And then finally the cat popped up in his dream and said, I'll take care of you, like, don't you worry about that. And then I think it was a day or two later, he became filthy rich because he just discovered a bag of gold somewhere. Nice. There's a lot of different variations of those stories, but that is kind of the core concept, and then that became popular. So I think the next story that came after that was very much along the lines of, it was some person was being skeptical, saw him get rich, you know, and he's like, yeah, it's the cat that got me rich. And literally the guy's like, nah, it couldn't be. So then he, you know, he took care of a cat, and then he got rich too. So then it kind of gets spread culturally that way.
Nice.
So there's different types of cats. I mean, in Japan, they would have different colors to symbolize different things. And the Chinese would follow suit on that also. So there's the five elements. So if you want, like, you know, more romance or promotion and all this stuff, you'd use red. If you want more health and mental acuity, you use green, etc. So different colors, different hand positions, all different meanings to the cats.
So there's some ritual involved in actually taking care of the cat too. It's not just enough to just have the cat on display, I'm assuming.
Well, no, usually you can just leave it on display. Is that really going to bring you luck? It's debatable, but it's a culturally accepted norm that you always buy a cat for a business or yourself.
Okay, that's nice.
I mean, you can do all that at ritual stuff for people that know how to. I mean, that's creating a servitor now, or, you know, you can start doing spirit work around it and all these things. But I mean, it's pretty much the norm of you just buy a cat and you're lucky.
Okay, I didn't know if there were certain offerings you were supposed to leave it, that kind of thing.
Nope. I mean, if you want more money, you leave it coins. If you want, like, certain other things, you do different things. But generally speaking, you just buy and that's it.
Well, that's cool. But, is there any little topics you'd like to broach in our little off-the-hook conversation this evening about the East and the West?
I mean, conversation's going pretty smooth and well, so I don't really have any conversation pieces that I'd like to breach or talk about. I mean, there is Buddhism, but that's always a huge conversation that I know we definitely don't got time for. But, you know, the stereotypes of what a Buddhist is and all that type of fun stuff.
Well, we could broach some of it, because the thing that I find interesting is more and more I'm realizing Buddhism would be a philosophy more than a religion.
Yes. I mean, I would say it's a philosophy. I would also say it's very similar to Gnostic Christianity if people have any practices around that. Because it basically goes with the point of life is suffering, what do you do about it? Well, it's an illusion. That's their logical conclusion. It's an illusion. So, I know I'm probably going to get some hate mail on this, but I'm a very Zen-based type of person. That's the first thing I'm going to say, which would say break all the rules anyways. But all the Dharma rules, all these things, these are practices for people. That's general. But there's a lot of specific practices depending on where you are, because it's quite unique in Buddhism where they'd say, well, are you in the Asura realm? Are you in the Deva realm? Are you in the... all these different levels of what it means to be a human. And none of them are bad. They just are what they are. But you got to find a unique practice onto yourself, which may not actually work within the tradition on its general guidelines. So this is in some ways inspiring or having you to aspire to be the Buddha within yourself, because you already are a Buddha. You forgot. So you just need to kind of research within yourself, do those meditations, and do whatever practices that guide you toward that point. Which gets into whole thoughts of logical analysis and reflection.
Yes. So, from that perspective, I'm trying to check the time. Oh, yeah, we have time.
We got time.
Yeah, we've been going at this about 53 minutes. We got a little bit of time before we can have to cut out of here.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm thinking, Zach, is so Buddhism, does Buddhism say life is suffering?
General premise on yes. Mind you, how the culture takes it, that's a different thing. Tibetan Buddhism is different than Chinese Buddhism. Indian Buddhism is different than Thailand Buddhism. But the general framework is, yeah, life is suffering. That's the point of starting. That's the first assumption you have to make in the system.
That's an easy assumption for me to make. I just tend to think that... well, it's just funny, because you know this isn't my area of expertise. That's why I love talking to you about it. The thing is, man, I have a personal theory. Before I knew anything about any Eastern philosophy, I have a personal theory that the harder you progress into magic, the harder the challenges get. It's like something about the nature of existence makes it so you can't just go, okay, I'm going to get pretty efficient at magic and my life's just going to get yip-skippity easier. It's like life always serves up a new challenge to go against the skills you've got.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like playing a video game on that. Next yeah. level, new boss.
Yeah, which is actually horrifying when you think about it. You know, it's like I'm telling you, what, you know, one week I'm telling you guys go out and find ways to improve your life, the next week I'm telling you, oh, by the way, after you improve your life there's gonna be a new challenge. It's horrifying, and I don't like it either. And as a magician, I look for ways to sidestep it. Haven't been successful yet. But I know
that... Well, I think we all do, man.
Oh, yeah. And the benefits moving forward outweigh those challenges, trust me. Mm-hmm. Your life does get better, it's just... And maybe... You know, God, I really don't want to buy into the idea that we're here to be trained, forced to grow, any of those ideas. I really don't. I want to buy into the fact that someday, man, I can just work doing something I enjoy and make enough money that my free time is just happy, joyous. But realistically, I look at the world and I go, there's people that have way more money than me, and they're miserable. Some of them. So really, it's never... There's something just built into this matrix. It's not the simple equation of, oh, make more money, worry about life less. Something always gets in the way. There's always a new challenge.
Well, right, and this is where, you know, Buddhism would say they're suffering. From a Gnostic Christian standard, it gets into, I forget the term, but it's like prison planet, right?
It is like prison planet. I don't like it, but I'm being honest.
Yeah, and I mean, from a Buddhist perspective, depending on which tradition you work from, I primarily work from the Chinese one, and we're greedy mofos on that. But it's basically like, oh, you want enlightenment? Great, okay, here's your stuff, here's your instant validation for results, and go make your life better. And then once you get your life together, then maybe you'll consider start working on spirituality more. That's actually much more on a Pure Land and Zen perspective. Spirituality is a journey, not a goal, because it assumes you need to go through that Maslow's hierarchy of needs.
Mm-hmm.
Buddhism, I mean, yes, you have the monks that cut off from everything, but generally speaking, it's working on that you need relationships, you need food, you need money, you need all these things in society, and yes, they are attachments. But from a Buddhist perspective, they're all illusions, too, that you should be able to just throw away easily. And if you choose to have those attachments, they are just choices you choose.
Well, and here's the funny thing. You need a lot less than you think you do.
Exactly.
I mean, yeah, you need climate control of some sort. You need food. You need shelter. You know, water. But the thing is, these monks that cut themselves off, they're still going through the hierarchy of needs. They have relationships with each other. It allows them to focus, be more focused on the work they're working on rather than be distracted by outside influences.
Exactly.
They set up a commune in a way that they're able to get their water and their food and their climate control, clothing, whatever, you know. So I think it's a misnomer to say that the spiritual person like that has... withdrawn, it's just they realize that their actual needs are a lot less than what you think yours are.
Exactly. So this is where, at least when you start looking at those Zen proverbs and things like that, like, you know, the typical stereotypical monk is that, a monk. But when you really look at and analyze the history, there's some Zen people that just want completely like, yeah, I'm going to own it. And then usually that starts getting into more of the Confucian realm of things, where you start becoming a really good Confucian, where you foster those relationships, you worry about the family, and you start developing your income and things like that, so you can be more generous with people. And that's the opposite spectrum of, well, asceticism. But you're still playing the game on that, and pushing your limits.
Well, in closing, Zach... Other than your seminar that I'm gonna post up on the website for everyone to check out, is there anything else you'd like to bring up?
Well, we got our Do Magic Challenge coming up.
What is the next Do Magic Challenge? Enchantments.
It's all enchantments. So I'm not sure if we're on the research phase right now or if we're going right into the go into enchantments. I gotta double check the schedule on that. But enchantments is the next thing coming up. So. Pop on to the Do Magic Challenge, go to the website, give us your links, and, you know, from there, good luck with everything, everyone, because it's going to be a fun challenge where you can enchant for whatever you want in your life.
Oh, you better start thinking, what are my wants as opposed to my needs? Everybody have a great week. I'm going to let the Illuminous take us on out with those happy thoughts. See you next week.